Hello, I'm Annabelle Crabb. Now, I wouldn't say I'm a hoarder exactly, but I do hang on to things. It's not just you and me. Australia's oldest library is crammed with stuff that isn't books. Terrible paintings, old menus, human hair. Is this history or hoarding? Come and have a rummage through the story of us told by our stuff. Search for the History or Hoarding podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Late Night Live, coming to you from Gadigal land. I'm David Marr. All through the ranks at Radio National are men and women who cut their teeth in community radio. Those stations run on the smell of an oily rag and the sweat of volunteers. Money's always been tight. But now, one of the most loved, 2SER in Sydney, is in mortal danger as Macquarie University stops funding. Later, a couple of passionate community radio advocates will explore the fate of 2SER and community radio more generally. And we're off to Norfolk Island, where, courtesy of the mighty Greenwich Maritime Museum, the descendants of the Bounty Mutineers have been reunited with the most precious document in their history, the Pitcairn Island Register. It's a great story of history brought alive. But first, from Springtime, Connecticut, Bruce Shapiro, contributing editor with The Nation, executive director at the Global Centre for Journalism and Trauma. Bruce, welcome.
Always glad to be here.
Now, last time we decided next time we'd look at Trump and the courts, and that time's arrived. A few days after the Supreme Court has shocked much of America by overturning 60 years of protection for minority voting rights. Bruce, what were the judges thinking?
What they were thinking is that all of this racism talk belongs to the past. This, while not a surprise, was nonetheless a shocking ruling from the conservative Supreme Court majority. It was a 6-3 ruling that found the key enforcement provision of the Voting Rights Act of 1965 passed at the height of the civil rights revolution to enable black voters to get representation, to get black officials elected through districting, right? Threw all of that out the window. And essentially, in a case involving the one majority minority district in Louisiana, the court majority said, oh, there was no intentional discrimination here. From now on, in order to prevail in a voting rights case or in order to have a majority-minority district anywhere, you're going to have to prove deliberate discrimination. You're going to have to prove that a whole bunch of politicians deliberately set out to dilute black voting power. The dissenters, led by Justice Kagan, Elena Kagan, Bill Clinton nominee, of course, or Obama nominee, rather, of course, said this becomes an insurmountable barrier. You have to remember that the way black political power in the Jim Crow South was historically controlled was by the endless gerrymandering of districts that would stay white, 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 white. And essentially, the court majority has now opened the door to that kind of warfare again. And what's interesting about it is that it's not just an argument about, is all of that fighting from the civil rights era a thing of the past? It's not just an argument about what does racism look like? Is it racism if somebody doesn't actually say, I'm making a racist decision here? But rather, it is about kind of unleashing the ability to endlessly redistrict onto state legislatures, which were already seeing in the wake of this, Louisiana, Alabama, and other states that have, you know, a small number of majority Democratic or majority black districts, their Republican legislatures, Florida, are already talking about quickly redistricting in order to help prevent a Democratic takeover of Congress this fall. And this is going to go back and forth and back and forth. It's doing for racially and politically motivated redistricting what the notorious Supreme Court decision, Citizens United, did for unleashing unregulated campaign funds. It is unleashing what will undoubtedly be a torrent of back and forth, highly polarized districting wars that will go on for years.
Bruce, one of the judges commented at one point that you don't need these protections anymore. But that is not a judgment. That is not something for judges to decide. That is a political decision.
And in fact, the Voting Rights Act was really quite clear. It's quite clear that it was a decision by Congress, by the legislature, and essentially what the supposedly conservative, a word I really just can't use anymore to describe this reactionary majority, what this majority essentially said was, we don't care what Congress said. We don't really even care that the Constitution makes this kind of thing the matter of legislation. Our view is that all this racism is a thing of the past, and now it's really up to state legislatures to district however they want. And this isn't just a matter of Congress. This is, under the U.S. system, going to affect races from dog catcher and little municipal races all the way up to Congress and Senate and so on. I mean, this is a decision that of the most profound importance for the dilution of black political strength. We're already looking at perhaps a historic cut in fall in black political representation, the greatest since really the post-Reconstruction days after the Civil War.
Yours is a baffling country, Bruce. Of course, we've got rid of gerrymandering, but let's not boast that. We're just a little country that shows that you can run politics without gerrymandering. But
Well, the U.S. showed that you could do it. For the last 60 years, the civil rights movement, led by, of course, by Dr. Martin Luther King and John Lewis and other courageous leaders, 60 years ago, they marched and sacrificed and got their heads beat in and in some cases were murdered in order to ensure that black folks could get political representation one way or another. This court, really for a generation, this gradually building court majority, it's not just a Trump thing at all, goes back to the Reagan years, has been steadily undercutting all of the legislation passed during the civil rights era, and this is one of the most profound cuts yet.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm speaking to Bruce Shapiro about the courts in America. Now, Bruce, it's your view that these massive defamation cases that Trump is mounting have a deeper purpose. What is that purpose?
Well, interestingly, this ties back to the civil rights era. Back in 1964, in a case involving criticism of public officials in the segregated South, the U.S. Supreme Court, in another one of the high watermarks for civil liberties, declared that public officials need to take their lumps, that free speech in America means robust, even caustic criticism of public officials, and that if for a public official to sue someone for defamation or to prevail in a libel case, you've really got to prove what they call absolute malice, deliberate malice, actual malice. Donald Trump, of course, has become famous, and his circle and his officials, for turning around every 5 minutes and suing some journalist for defamation. Trump sued Rupert Murdoch in the Wall Street Journal. Cash Patel has sued the Atlantic Monthly, which pointed out that agents have been calling him J. Edgar Boozer. Sorry, I just had to get that in.
And we're grateful that you did, Bruce. We're grateful.
And, you know, on the surface, you can say, well, these are just strategic lawsuits against public participation, slap suits. They're designed to intimidate. But really, what they are trying to do is hoping that one of these cases, which judges keep throwing out of court, like the Wall Street Journal case, which got 2 weeks ago a federal judge dismissed out of hand as ridiculously unjustified under that 1964 ruling.
How much was he after from Rupert Murdoch?
$10 billion.
$10 billion, yep.
And both the amount, but also the terrain of the lawsuit. It was for a news story involving Trump's relationship with Epstein. It was all factually accurate.
Oh, it was
accurate.
About the birthday card.
It was about the birthday
We've
card.
We've seen and, the birthday you know, card.
There was no actual malice, and also fact is an absolute protection under New York Times versus Sullivan, the great precedent from the civil rights era that has defined American political speech for more than a half century. Trump and his cohort are hoping that one of these cases will get to the Supreme Court and is hoping that today's Supreme Court will in fact overrule that civil rights era case and will make it much easier for public officials and other public figures to sue for defamation, to intimidate critics. And there's a good reason to think they might rule that way. Several of the current sitting justices, Justice Clarence Thomas, Justice Brett Kavanaugh, both of them confirmed under the shadow of sexual abuse allegations, have publicly criticized that New York Times versus Sullivan decision from 1964. So there's real hope in the Trump world that somehow the power of billionaires and oligarchs and politicians to intimidate their opponents through defamation cases and libel cases will somehow be restored to the American landscape as it existed during the Jim Crow era and as it existed prior to that crucial First Amendment decision in 1964.
Meanwhile, Bruce, how's Trump's record on obeying the courts, on doing what they direct his administration to do?
Well, this, of course, is he's key. Trump will appeal, first of all, as he has done in the case of the defamation case he lost, the defamation case brought by E. Jean Carroll, whom he actually did defame, and he's owed he owes $65 million to. There, he's refused to pay it and is appealing it. So that's one rule. But secondly, what we've seen over and over again in this second Trump administration is when the federal courts issue rulings on immigration enforcement, issue rulings on funding, issue rulings on the firings of USAID officials and closures of federal agencies. When courts rule against Trump, he simply ignores them and barrels forward. We've begun to see some courts getting very tough in their language with the real threat of contempt of court. But of course, we've already had, again, the Supreme Court majority holding the president himself exempt from criminal prosecution during his term. So, you know, Trump thinks he's on pretty high ground in defying courts over and over again. So what we're seeing are courts becoming an instrument of politics by other means, an instrument of continuing and extending the spectacle of right-wing politics and of Trump anarchy and enrichment.
And of course, the enrichment is the point, surely, that along the way, even if he isn't yet able to boot one of these cases up to the Supreme Court, he's making money along the way. People are settling with him, $15 million here, $20 million there. It all helps,
Bruce. Well, and it helps. Well, no, and there's extraordinary amounts of money that involved in people who don't want to fight these cases. We've also seen the great some of the great institutions of American society, law firms, universities, including my own former employer, Columbia University, settle not to pay Trump personally, but to pay the federal government huge amounts of money. We even have now the extraordinary spectacle of a case that Trump, as president, has brought against his own government, against the IRS, for fines it says he owes them. And the novel question has come up, can the Justice Department, which works for Trump, prosecute a case or defend a case, or what side is the Justice Department on? We're in an extraordinary moment in which the courts are simply becoming another vehicle for the Trump circus.
And for extraordinary moments, we rely on Bruce Shapiro, contributing editor with The Nation, executive director at the Global Center for Journalism and Trauma. Bruce, thank you. Back soon.
As always.
This is Late Night Live. Coming up, the plight of community radio. Macquarie University seemed almost in tears, telling Late Night Live its cherished role of supporting Sydney Community Radio Station 2SER was ending after more than 40 years. Its contributions to students, staff and Sydney's communities have been deeply valued, Macquarie assured us. We know firsthand the vital contribution the station makes to our media landscape and wider community, and we hope this continues long into the future. But no more money from Macquarie. Well, how much? Well, lately it's been about $400,000 a year. What's Macquarie's annual income these days? It's hard to say, but it's north of $1 billion. Millions of people listen to community radio across Australia, 2SER in Sydney, Triple R in Melbourne, Koori Radio in Sydney, 4ZZZ in Brisbane, and there are many, many more. 2SER trains the radio hands of the nation, many, many of them here at the ABC. Three of Late Night Live's team have volunteered as producers and presenters in their youth on 2SER. Community radio is under challenge across the country, but that one of the best stations, 2SER, well, that's my view, best stations, might be facing the chops come as a real shock. Mind you, the fight is not over. To discuss, I'm joined by Chris Nash, founding professor of journalism at Monash University and a member of the newly established 2SER Working Group, and John Bissett, CEO of the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia. Welcome to Late Night Live. Chris, what's the situation now at SER? What's the outlook?
The outlook is very tight. Macquarie has very definitely pulled out. Macquarie has wanted to be out for almost as long as the station has been on air, and was kept in by the other partner, what became UTS, what was originally the New South Wales Institute of Technology. I was on the board of the station for 4 or 5 years back in those first years it was on air. And to be fair, I'd say they never quite saw the reason why they were doing this. For UTS, it was thoroughly integrated with the communications degree. Anyone who was studying radio had to get something broadcast before it could be assessed, which just meant that the students were then the backbone of the station, and it was enormously good publicity. And so even though the university wasn't quite sure, again, why it had a radio station, it gave them enormous prestige, as particularly with the high ATAR marks required to get into the communication program. So it worked for many, many years. I think with, you know, the universities are in a crisis, financial crisis, except for two or three, and some very hard decisions are being made. And so unless something is perceived to be core to your financial survival, UTS is saying that it is unwavering in its commitment to 2SER, I think that's partly because the last couple of weeks have seen a fair bit of coverage in the media.
There's been uproar.
That's right. There has, because half of the ABC and commercial television and print journalism in this country are graduates of UTS.
And I would like to say that I've promoted many of my books onto SER. Oh,
I'm sure you have. I'm sure you've got...
I've been down to those studios, been grilled by sharp-minded students, I've
exactly,
got to say.
Exactly. Yeah. Who don't owe you anything.
No, don't owe a thing. It's brutal, it's brutal. Well, why doesn't UTS just foot the whole bill?
Well, things are very tight there too. And they've produced a budget, a prospectus budget, where ideally they'd like to see effectively three partners, so, you know, $1.5 million a year, and that's not forthcoming at the moment. So they're going to, at the moment they're saying what they're going to do is foot the bill at a much reduced level and then really try and restructure and reconceptualise, I think, what they're doing over the coming period. But that's a very welcome, that commitment, that unwavering commitment in their words is very welcome because it gives the station time.
Who else has been turned to for money? What?
The initial proposal was UNSW and Sydney, and I'm told that they declined.
UNSW and yeah. Sydney. Well, Sydney's just about broke, isn't it?
It is.
Yes. They've only got hundreds of millions of dollars in kitty. No,
very thin gruel.
Yes, thin gruel up on the hill, I must say. Yeah. Isn't one of the problems here, Chris, that why Macquarie gave fair warning? I mean, it last September.
Yes, you can't fault Macquarie.
You know, last September they said 2026 is our last time we're going to be funding to SER. But things seem to be moving terribly slowly. I mean, we're in May 2026 and the thing is still in flux.
That's true, but also there were staff changeovers at UTS and so there wasn't really anybody in a position to make a decision until the beginning of this year. And that person had to get his head across what the situation was because he'd come from the UK, the current Dean James
right.
Bennett.
Right, okay. So let me bring in John Bissett here. John, you're CEO of the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia. How are community stations going in this country? Is the experience at 2SER typical of the pressure that other community stations are finding?
I think the current economic climate, lots of organisations are facing pressures. So I don't think pressure is new. I don't think that many stations are being impacted like 2SER is. I think, you know, most stations are not funded by a university and therefore not at the whims of those universities. They have much more diverse revenue streams and are operating to some degree maybe a little bit more sustainably, a little bit more smaller. So I think it's an interesting time for the sector. Listener numbers are growing. They're not shrinking.
What are they roughly?
So a little over about 5.3 million listeners per week to the 300 stations across the country, delivering about 500 services, so quite substantial. Those numbers have been pretty steady for 20 years. So that's looking really good. Again, tough economic times. Like most media organisations, advertising, or we call it sponsorship, is not growing. It's pretty flat. Government funding also, you know, despite some inputs last year, some increases last year to the government, is pretty flat over the period too.
Right. But it employs quite a lot of people, doesn't it? Apart from, I mean, thousands of volunteers, but there's actually professional staff as well involved here.
Yeah, look, 18,000 volunteers across the country, and as you know, you said right at the beginning, many people that are in media across the country, whether that's ABC, SBS, commercial, have come through community radio. It's such a breeding ground for professionals, and you're right, about 1,000 staff as well.
Yeah. How else can you fund it? I mean, you suggested a moment ago that universities funding community stations is actually an unusual arrangement.
There's about seven or eight stations that are parts or have connections, collaborations with universities. That's out of 300 entities, so a small percentage, but very important stations like 2SER or 2NUR in Newcastle. Formerly Radio Adelaide, that was probably the most recent example of a yes. university pulling out of a community radio station. 3RRR in Melbourne, SYN in Melbourne, there's quite a few of them.
Now, there was a town hall meeting about 2SER recently, and there's some very odd things going on here where a tape of the meeting isn't kind of really generally publicly available. What's all this about? Do you know?
No, but quite a few people had their phones running, so there are lots of transcripts of what was said.
Yes, but it's hard to keep these things under wraps, isn't it?
Yes. Look, I think the universities have been evaluating where they get their money from, and particularly if they're getting their money from international students, and what contributes to the reputation that they have with international students. And a lot of that is a fairly conservative evaluation of research outputs, particularly from the sciences, which are very, very expensive. So they are putting the axe through a whole lot of things that they see as extraneous. I would argue, and I've spent my career in universities. I started at the ABC and then went to...
You found a life.
So I went to it.
You found a life, yes.
I found life, that's right. I would argue, and I think Radio National is a really good example of it, that journalism can be the cutting edge of the humanities. If you look at what happens on the health report, the law report, programs like this, what you get is really serious journalism focused on what's happening in the world, viewed through the lens of the professions or through the lens of the disciplines. That is a great thing, I would argue, for a university to be doing. That was a great thing for staff, but also for students to be able to put out there onto the broadcast, so not for their mum and their boyfriend or their girlfriend, but a serious audience who may well give them feedback, ideas about the world that they're sort of engaging with. And as I say, Radio National is a really good example of the fruition of that. That is very hard to put a dollar and cents value on. And if that's how universities are looking at their future, and God knows they are under very serious financial constraints, then it tends to fall through the cracks. Now, I think I'm really pleased that the University of Technology here has actually come to the table and said their commitment to this program. They said that their commitment to 2SER is unwavering. Precisely how that plays out, we'll see.
We'll see, yes.
We'll see. But nonetheless, it's an improvement on 2 weeks ago.
And Chris, is this cutback on the part of the universities part of the waning enthusiasm of students to study journalism?
There aren't the jobs in journalism that there were when I started, both in journalism and then subsequently in academia. Fee-paying master's programs, which used to be huge. The Masters of Arts in Journalism at UTS was bigger than the undergraduate program, and that was fee-paying. Yeah. So there's no return on that now because of the lack of employment in journalism. But students are still going into the arts and humanities at the same level as they were previously, and journalism is a really important component of that. So journalism is still an attractive part of an arts degree or a communication degree. It's just not seen as the ticket to money that it was originally.
Well, ticket to money is a typically brutal way of you, Chris, expressing it, but it's not a pathway to a career in the way that it was.
Well, you've got to get the money to repay your HEX.
There's that.
Your $50,000 for your arts degree.
That was an invention that came along after my time. John, what are the other ways of funding community radio if universities aren't going to kick in?
I think each station does it differently, and I think that's really important to acknowledge. Stations are getting money through as I think I said before, sponsorship, the large number of stations that are getting listener support, whether that's through donations, whether that's through some sort of subscription, that's a huge revenue stream for a number of stations. Particularly, it seems to be in Victoria that subscription, and to some degree in Perth too, that subscriptions work really well. I mean, 3RRR has 12, 13,000, I think, supporters annually contributing to their service. So there's lots of those sorts of opportunities. Government funding's incredibly important, and I think the government sees the importance and the role of community radio, whether that's through the pathways that we've talked about to journalism, whether that's through supporting Australian artists, or just the role it can play in social cohesion, in giving people the opportunity to have their say in their language or through their culture.
And in their region, in their homes, hometowns. I've got an impression that community radio is particularly strong in Melbourne. Is that right?
Definitely. I think there's a real
and
culture.
Why?
The why, I don't know, but I grew up in Melbourne, and certainly I grew up listening to 3RRR and listening to PBS, which are two really strong stations that are still there, and 3CR, another incredibly strong station in Melbourne. I just think there's been this culture. It's been said to me that maybe it was because Double J wasn't there in the early days.
The ABC didn't send Double J to Melbourne.
Well, not till whenever that was.
I find that unbelievable.
I don't know if that's true, but that's certainly what's been
national.
Said to me.
Double J was national.
Yes.
Originally, though, or Triple?
I think Melbourne just might have taken a bit of time to tune in. That's maybe inconceivable. And
Melbourne also got Double Z, which was the non-English language radio station. And quite a few people went from the ABC, actually, to work on that.
To Double Z.
Yes.
Yeah. Chris, you seemed a moment ago, and I cut you off, but you seemed to be a little bit optimistic about the fate of 2SER.
I am a little bit. I was a bit surprised at the strength of the statement that the university gave you prior to tonight's program.
The full statement will be up on our website, of course. Yeah.
So I think that's really good, and I think they are feeling their way.
Terrific. Well, that looks perhaps a little bit hopeful. I've been talking to Chris Nash, founding professor of journalism at Monash University, and John Bissett, CEO of Community Broadcasting Association of Australia, about the fate of 2SER. Coming up, the islanders who have now got their hands on their foundational document. Though it had little or nothing to do with Australia, the mutiny on the Bounty has become one of the foundational stories of the nation. So many novels, so many films, so many histories, and now a wonderful document, the Pitcairn Island Register, lent by the National Maritime Museum at Greenwich to the descendants of the mutineers now living on Norfolk Island. Its full title, The Pitcairn Island Register, From the Destruction of the Bounty Up to the Present Time, begun in 1823. It begins with a few sad lines on the fate of the mutineers. Where are they now, the infatuated band, whose outraged feelings urged them on to crime? Proscribed, they wandered on from land to land, till Pitcairn came and perished in their prime. Well, not all of them, not the women and children and their descendants, who include Dr. Pauline Reynolds, Chair of the Norfolk Island Museums Trust and Adjunct Fellow at Macquarie University, who negotiated with Greenwich for the long loan of the register. Pauline joins me now, and with her is Helen Mears, Head of Curatorship and Research at Greenwich. Helen is deeply interested in the decolonising of museum practice, and she carried the register from Britain to Norfolk Island. Pauline, welcome. Helen, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Helen, the document itself, what does it look like? What sort of state is it in?
In some ways, for an object of such great significance, there's something quite unprepossessing about it. It's a bound volume. We think the binding was applied later. So it's a manuscript. It's a handwritten volume of quite slender size. And it's currently installed at the Pier Store, part of Norfolk Island Museums.
They stopped using it on Pitcairn when the document became so dilapidated and waterlogged that it wasn't much use anymore. I take it it's been repaired.
It's actually in very good condition for its age and particularly for its provenance. So it's quite perhaps more robust than one might think. And the water damage is evident. There's a sort of band of, yes, of water staining across the top, but not as dilapidated as George Hunnob's comments might suggest.
But Pauline, how did you find out about this document?
Well, it was in 2022 that actually the great-great-grandson of John Buffett, who was actually the scribe of the register, he was looking online and he actually discovered that the register was there at the National Maritime Museum. I had actually seen it in 2010 and I had never had the idea to bring it to Norfolk, but that was Mervyn Buffett's very strong wish that it come to the community on Norfolk Island, the descendants of the people that are written about in the register.
1787, the Bounty leaves England and goes off to collect breadfruit from Tahiti. And they all have a wonderful time in Tahiti. Is that right?
Well, in 1788, in October, the Bounty actually arrived on the shores of Tahiti and they stayed there for 5 months, and that was the longest that any foreign ship had ever stayed in Tahiti. And so, of course, during that time, relationships began, friendships, allyships, and also romances. So, and then, of course, after 5 months, they left, and as they sailed up near the island of Tonga, the crew mutinied, and that story has become incredibly famous, yes, in naval maritime history, of course.
And the men take the Bounty back to Tahiti for a bit, and then finally they end up in Pitcairn. How many people came ashore at Pitcairn before they burnt the Bounty?
Okay, so there were 9 mutineers and there were 12 women and a baby girl and 6 Polynesian men. So they were overwhelmingly a Polynesian group of settlers, and but the British sailors, of course, had the power, I suppose.
Well, they had the power, but things were pretty grim for the sailors and for the Tahitian men. I mean, essentially, they just slaughtered one another, didn't they?
That is true, yes. In the first 3 years, most of the men were killed. And by Christmas Day, 1800, the year 1800, there was only one man left, and that was John Adams.
So there they are, all on the island. And then in 1823, there's a passing whaling boat, and ashore comes...
This is John Buffett, the original author of the register, who starts the author. So he's a Bristol shipwright and a very talented carpenter. And he comes aboard and becomes an instructor, a source of educational and religious guidance to the community.
But the really important thing is that this is 30 years after the mutineers came to Pitcairn, but Buffett decides to get their stories from the moment of the landing. And therefore, he is writing the first history, is he not?
The first ship to come across Pitcairn was in 1808, and that was the Topaz. And that was, it was a sealing ship. And so they came across the community and they wrote about the community. So from 1808 up until 1823, it's not very long, but ships captains and sailors had become really, really interested. And so there were some records, but the Pitcairn Register is the first record from within the community, and that's what's really important.
And it's not just births, deaths and marriages. It's also murders, suicides, everything is there. In very, very shorthand, but it's there.
Yes, but getting beyond the gore, there's also this underlying story of women raising children and many children being born and entertaining ships that came in and taking care of people as they came onto the island.
And I know that this is what interests you, that so much of the story of the mutiny has been written about the men and their crimes, their deaths, etc., etc., etc. But the whole thing only succeeds. Is this right, Pauline? If the whole thing only succeeds because of the women.
Yes, well, when they arrived in 1790, it was January 1790, so the heat of summer, they arrived at a Polynesian island, so they recognised the plants, they recognised the birds and the fish, and because there was also Polynesian men that came with them, but they did understand how that island worked. They were islanders themselves and familiar with what was there already. I do believe that those British men would not have survived on their own. They didn't have... Those women brought a particular kind of knowledge with them that was absolutely needed.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Maher, and I'm talking to Pauline Reynolds, Chair of the Norfolk Island Museums Trust, and Helen Mears, Head of Curatorship and Research at the Royal Museums of Greenwich, about this extraordinary book, The Pitcairn Register. Pauline, the survival of the book now depends on missionaries. How is it that the book gets from Pitcairn to Britain?
It's a really wonderful story, actually. So in 1852, by then, George Hun Nobbs, who was another Englishman that settled amongst the islanders and married into a family, the Christian family, my family, he was visited by Fairfax Moresby, who arrived and then said to him, "You need to be ordained as a minister." So he actually paid for him to get to England. And so in the time that he was going to be gone, they asked the Reverend Holman, who was aboard that ship, I think it's the Portland. And so the Reverend Holman stayed on the island, and he was actually became the third scribe that's in the book. So there's three writers in that book. And so then he went away, Nobbs went away, Holman's there, and then they have the first steamer to ever visit the island, the Virago, and the captain of the steamer offered the whole population to go around the island, to do a tour around the island. And, of course, the Reverend Holman was very excited and took the register with him and then accidentally dropped it into the water. Oh. They must have gotten it out pretty quickly because it's not so badly damaged, all that we can see today anyway. Mm. Obviously, some great conservation has gone into the book. So then when George Hun Nobbs returned to the island a few months later, he kept riding in it until 1854, and then he decided that it needed to be sent to his good friend, the Reverend Murray in London, who was a secretary for the Society of the Promotion of Christian Knowledge, and it ended up in their collections.
And Helen, how did it get from there to Greenwich?
So the Society, moving on in time, the Society loaned it to the museum, to the National Maritime Museum in 1989 for the exhibition Mutiny on the Bounty, which marked the 200th anniversary since the mutiny. So they generously loaned it for the exhibition. And then just less than a decade later, in 1998, the Society gifted it to what was then Royal Museums Greenwich on to mark the Society's 300th anniversary. And since then, it's remained in the collection. And since 2018, it's been on display in the museum's Pacific Encounters Gallery.
So this is a story which is so familiar in research of a document which is actually quite famous coming to the attention of the people for whom it is really, that it really, really matters, led by you, Pauline, and the linking up of the two. But Pauline, when did you start to try to work out who the women in your family were? Was it after you discovered the register, or had this been going on for some time already?
Oh, at least 30-odd years ago. I was here on Norfolk Island. I was learning to dance. I was sitting in a circle with some beautiful women at our centre, and one of the elder women said, "What about dem wahine on our bounty? What about those women on the bounty?" And that was the thing that triggered something inside me. Later on, I visited Tahiti, and then after that, I went back and I lived there and I raised my two children. And I think living there, I tried to find, how could I find the traces of these women? I was confused that we didn't know their names, that we didn't speak much about them because we didn't know much about them. And so that began my journey. So I started looking for the cloth, or tapa cloth is what we call it, or bark cloth, that they made, and I contacted museums around the world to see if they had any in their collections. And fortunately, I've found about 60 or 70 so far.
And that cloth tells you the story of your family?
That cloth is the remnant of those women. There's nothing that exists except their DNA in me and our community, but also they've left their words in our language, and they're cooking in the food that we cook, and remnant parts of our culture, the weaving that we do. But what I wanted to find was material culture. And the interesting thing about the tapa cloth that they made, is it has indications of their kind of position in society by the dyes that they used, by the fineness of the cloth that they made. They were really elite makers of bark cloth.
Was it your idea that the register should go to Norfolk Island, where the mutineers' descendants had shifted when? In about 1850, something like that, they moved from Pitcairn to Norfolk?
It wasn't my idea to bring the register to Norfolk Island. It was Mervyn Buffett, who is the great-great-grandson of John Buffett, the original scribe of
yes,
the register, and his partner Claire. And they approached the Norfolk Island Museum Trust, basically. There was, you know, quite a bit of discussion on how to go about this. But first of all, they actually approached the National Maritime Museum and the Royal Museums Greenwich, and that was the beginning of an amazing relationship.
Helen, what was the response of your museum to this request?
I think wholehearted support and interest, as you've outlined. The kind of basic outline of the history of the mutiny is well known to those of us in the UK. But this sort of, I think the legacies of that history, the fact that there were communities still, you know, the descendants were still living on Pitcairn and on Norfolk Island, was really compelling. And so what started as a very short email from Mervyn Buffett became a much longer and more complex and involved conversation between colleagues at the National Maritime Museum and colleagues here, our peers here, both Merv and his partner Claire, but also Norfolk Island Museum Trust and also Norfolk Island Council of Elders. So it became a much more involved and sustained conversation that spanned several years now.
Yeah.
And Helen, what could the museum do? Could it give the register to the islanders?
like many national museums in Britain, in England, the National Maritime Museum is bound by the terms of its founding act, the National Maritime Museum Act of 1934. And Merv and Claire's ambitions was to see the register transferred fully to Norfolk Island Museum Trust. The terms of the National Maritime Museum's Act only allow for what's termed disposal, also deaccession and transfer, in very specific circumstances, whether something's a duplicate item, whether it's in really poor condition, whether it has no potential for display or research, or objects that pose a specific health and safety risk. There isn't currently scope to look at deaccession on an ethical or moral basis. And that's a situation that obviously is familiar to many people in terms of the British Museum, the V&A. But we have been fully committed throughout to taking the opportunity of building a strong and cooperative relationship with stakeholders here on Norfolk Island. And I should mention also Pitcairn Island. We hosted the mayor, the then mayor, Simon Young, at the museum last year, and seeking to develop a really strong relationship and also exploring opportunities for knowledge sharing, which is something ongoing as I'm here in Norfolk Island at present.
Pauline, what was the response of the people on Norfolk Island to seeing the register itself? I mean, they knew of it and you could go online and, you know, get the details, but to see the book itself?
Incredibly emotional. It's been a very unifying journey to get here. So we've, you know, the community was absolutely activated to fundraise and to support in kind and many different ways to get it here. So we had an unveiling event on last Friday, last week, and we had well over 100 people in a very small space. And what was really important, what I really want to say, is the community sees the Pitcairn Register as our book of origins. It contains our genealogy. It explains how we are an Anglo-Polynesian people. We are Indigenous to the Pacific. It shows how our language and our culture came to be and how we are a unique people. And so we all feel very, very proud to have this book here, this book of origins, here on our shores, on our land, and that we're able to go and visit 6 days a week down at the museum. It's very, very fulfilling and incredibly grounding and exciting at the same time.
Pauline, you've written a song about the story of the women. What does the song say?
The song is actually just the names of the women. So it actually took quite a bit of research to find these names and then put them into the context, because they were written mostly by English men. So I had to work through how they were actually written in Tahitian. So the song is actually the names of the women. It's called Tupuna Wahine, which means ancestresses, and they deserve to be remembered and named and sung for.
And your daughter has sung the song.
Yes, she has.
Let's hear the song now.
Moatua, moatua, moatua wahine, moatua te ehu te atu.
Helen, Pauline, thank you very much for joining us for this conversation to mark the return of the register to Norfolk Island. Helen Mears, Head of Curatorship and Research at Royal Museums Greenwich, and Dr. Pauline Reynolds, Chair of the Norfolk Island Museums Trust. This is Late Night Live. On our next, two opposition politicians in Israel have joined forces to try to bring down Benjamin Netanyahu at the elections in October. They've teamed up and split before. So what does the 2026 reunion of Naftali Bennett and Yair Lapid mean for Israel's leadership and the wars it's waging in Iran, Gaza, and Lebanon?